Next case, Gibbs versus Bonatta. Mr. Pope.
May it please the court. Thomas Gibbs is 58 years old and has been in prison for the last almost 20 years, since 1984 when he was convicted of 19 counts of burglary and 19 related counts of theft and of being an habitual offender. On direct appeal, Gibbs' counsel challenged the burglary and theft convictions on the ground that the judge allowed the state to introduce evidence of 39 uncharged burglaries. Counsel, however, failed to challenge the habitual offender determination on the same grounds, and that conviction stood. Counsel's failure to challenge the habitual offender determination constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel and Gibbs is therefore entitled to a writ of habeas corpus. The standard for ineffective assistance is whether counsel's performance was constitutionally deficient and the defense is prejudiced as a result. Performance is deficient if counsel omits a significant and obvious argument with no legitimate reason for doing so. The argument
but
here...
Isn't the problem that if he committed two of these offenses, which he did, which is not argued about, then he's a habitual offender?
If he committed two prior...
Right. So these others, what, 17 or 34, I don't know.
17.
They don't seem to add anything.
The extraneous convictions
right.
Don't add anything to the habitual offender determination? No, they don't. I mean, Gibbs' argument is that the 39 uncharged burglaries are prejudicial. Both in the conviction.
But how so, if two automatically makes you a habitual offender?
Because the uncharged burglaries are not relevant and they're highly prejudicial here.
But how are they prejudicial if two is automatic? Let me put the same question in a slightly different way. It looked to me like the argument at the sentencing hearing was an argument for jury nullification. That even though it was established, it was conceded there were two priors, the jury should disregard the statute, and putting in the evidence of these 39 other uncharged crimes made jury nullification less likely. But how is losing a chance at jury nullification prejudice in a legal sense?
I would say this is not jury nullification we're talking about here. I think under the Indiana Constitution, this is just the opposite. Indiana juries, especially in habitual offender proceedings, are bound to determine the facts and the law.
Yes,
and
but there was no denial that there were two legitimate priors, and more than two legitimate priors.
I don't think that means that's established conclusively from the evidence that there was. The fact that the trial counsel essentially conceded that there were doesn't make it so, and I think that was counsel's mistake.
Is it your view that this Indiana constitutional rule converts all legal rules in Indiana into discretionary issues for juries?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say in habitual offender proceedings, the Indiana constitutional provision is particularly important, and it's been held.
Why?
Because we're talking about a particularly harsh sentence. 30 years, up to 30 years.
I thought you were relying on the C case, is that right? C versus State?
Yes, well, those...
That case recognized some kind of discretionary authority. And the State says, well, the C case was decided long after the trial in this case.
The C case is not the only case we're relying on, and it was decided after...
With a lawyer back when this case was being tried or appealed, would he have recognized this doctrine?
he would have recognized this doctrine, and I think trial
counsel... Why would he recognize it? It was, I don't... It was not fully recognized, at least, until the C case.
Well, trial counsel recognized it in his closing statement. The judge at trial recognized it in his instructions to the jury, that the jury's got the right to find that the defendant is not a habitual offender.
Is that an instruction given in all cases in Indiana?
I believe it is given in all criminal cases. And it was given at this time with respect to the habitual offender determination. So I think it can be said that...
And are lawyers permitted to argue for nullification on the basis of the instruction?
Well, I think they're permitted to argue that the... I wouldn't call it nullification, but that the jury is the arbiter of the law and the facts. They're permitted to make that argument.
Are they permitted to say that since you have the last word on the law, you can disregard this law, it's overly harsh?
I don't think they can say you can disregard the law. I think they say you can determine what the law is and apply the facts to that law. As I said...
Well, if the law is unequivocal, then what is there?
Well...
Sorry.
I don't think you can have a case where something is entirely unequivocal. I mean, I think if you give the jury...
Law says if you've got two priors, then you're a habitual criminal. You know, there are federal statutes of the same kind. You're an armed career criminal if you have three priors for crimes of violence. And there may be legitimate questions about whether the prior is for a crime of violence or whether the defendant is the person, you know, convicted on this piece of paper. But if the defendant is the convict and if these are crimes of violence, you know, three prior murders, there's no doubt whatsoever that he's an armed career criminal. And it looks to me like Indiana law is the same, that if he's the person so named, and if these were qualifying crimes, then that the jig is off.
Well, I agree that it would look that way, but I think Indiana is different than the federal jurisdiction and almost every other state.
Federal courts may follow Indiana any moment. Almendarez-Torres case that says these are questions for the judge in the federal system, does not appear to have current majority support on the Supreme Court, but I would think if the federal court follows Indiana to make this a jury question, the jury's going to be told, find out if this defendant is the person convicted on those convictions, and you know, find out if these were qualifying crimes, and then your job is over.
Well,
they aren't going to be told, well, you can do it if it's in your discretion to do it.
Well, I think the cases in Indiana, based on the Indiana constitutional provision, say otherwise.
But Say doesn't say it's in the jury's discretion to do this.
Well, Say says that even in light of uncontroverted evidence of two prior convictions, the jury could still find that as a matter of law, the defendant was not an habitual offender. I think that in so many words says that it's not just an application of fact. This is a legal question that the jury has discretion.
Is that what the lawyer argued to the jury?
I'm sorry?
Is that what the lawyer argued, what his lawyer argued to the jury?
Yes, that's essentially what trial counsel argued in closing arguments. I think, you know, to bring the focus back to appellate counsel's conduct and performance, which is the thing that's at issue here, you know, the argument that these 39 uncharged crimes were prejudicial in the habitual offender proceeding is an obvious argument, and it's the same exact argument he made with respect to the conviction phase. And I think Gibbs was prejudiced as a result, and I think that's demonstrated by the fact that the Indiana Supreme Court vacated 34 of 38 convictions.
And what was the problem with those convictions?
The prejudicial, the 39 uncharged crimes were prejudicial evidence, and they were, you know, originally introduced as probative of identity, as modus operandi. The Indiana Supreme Court rejected that position.
Could they have been introduced? Could they have been used? Could the prosecutor have introduced them at the habitual offender stage to argue that this person really is a habitual offender?
Not the uncharged crimes. I mean, there are cases that say charged crimes may be used because, you know, maybe if you lose on one of the ones you're trying to use, it's two priors, you fall back on another. uncharged crimes, in all the cases I've seen, are not proper evidence of additional offender proceeding. Mm-hmm. It looks like my time is short.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pope. Mr. Martin?
May it please the court. The district court properly denied habeas relief because appellate counsel did not render sufficient performance and petitioner was not prejudiced by appellate counsel's performance. The four remaining convictions that were sustained by the Indiana Supreme Court on direct appeal were legitimate convictions, untainted or undermined by the admission of the uncharged acts. And those were, of course, the predicate for proceeding on to a habitual offender proceeding. Just as the admission of the 39 uncharged acts were harmless with respect to those four convictions, which had the strongest evidence behind them in support at the trial, the 39 uncharged acts which were admitted in the trial did not affect the jury's determination that petitioner was an habitual offender. The state had charged four predicate prior unrelated felonies to support the habitual offender charge, and I would direct the court's attention to the post-conviction court's order where it evaluates this evidence and the sufficiency of it in terms of proving the sequence of the convictions and the petitioner's identity. In terms of deficient performance, I think that it's correct that the state of Indiana law at the time of petitioner's direct appeal was that the jury did not have this special role that C established.
There wasn't any case that said exactly that, though, was there?
That said what C said, Your Honor?
It said the opposite of C earlier.
Actually, Jones does make a statement that the Jones v. State, it's cited in my brief, Your Honor, it's decided June 14th, 1983.
There are a number of cases after that, though, that were before the trial and appeal here.
And some of them, Your Honor, yes, contained language and concurring opinions that seem to acknowledge that this provision of the Indiana Constitution, Article 1, Section 19, was appropriate in any kind of criminal or criminally related proceeding. And I think that eventually that segued into the decision that was rendered in C. But my point is simply that at the time of the direct appeal, appellate counsel surely would not have been deficient for declining to raise this claim given the holding in Jones. And when you look at the prejudice in this case, it really illustrates that there was no deficient performance. In terms of having argued something other than the sufficiency of the proof supporting the habitual offender, appellate counsel would have been in the position of trying to show that with regard to the habitual offender, the jury, had they not been exposed previously to 39 uncharged acts at the trial, would not have found petitioner to have committed two predicate prior unrelated felonies.
No, I don't think that's his point. I think they would have found the same thing, but they can exercise lenity, at least if this, you know, C case were applicable here.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And with regard to that, just to sum up, with C, that made law what the trial court actually allowed petitioner to do with this habitual offender proceeding, and had the state, based on Jones, argued against the jury being instructed that it could essentially disregard the law, I think that objection would have been sustained. And counsel did argue that the jury, under that constitutional provision, could find the defendant to not be an habitual offender if it so chose, in spite of otherwise adequate proof of the prior felony. And it declined to do so, and I think that in considering that, appellate counsel was not deficient for failing to raise this claim.
But if C had been enforced, he would have been, wouldn't he?
Counsel would have been deficient?
Deficient.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because of the strength of the... In fact, Strickland states that nullification or tendencies or whims of jury...
No, this is not whims. This is a constitutional right. An Indiana constitutional right.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's not a matter of whim. If the state says that a jury can disregard the law, then that's not a whim. That becomes part of the legal entitlement of the criminal defendant. He can argue to the jury that they should disregard this rule.
And he did. And they did not.
And he could have done it more effectively if those 34, whatever they were, prior crimes had not been before the jury.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But I think that ultimately the jury, that there's not a reasonable probability that the jury would have not found him an habitual offender given the strength of the state's proof on the prior felonies.
Well, because the state's proof of the prior felonies and the jury's judgment whether this law is too harsh are two completely separate things. We can agree the jury would have found these four prior, they're really two, aren't they? They're just the two burglaries, but they're four
The predicate offenses, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Three and the post-conviction...
Well, whatever they are.
Oh, okay.
The jury could say, yes, this is... Yeah, he did commit these crimes, but we don't think that's enough to mark him as a habitual offender.
Your Honor, in response to...
Suppose a three-year-old is taught to brush his teeth. He brushes his teeth twice. Is he a habitual toothbrusher?
If the Indiana...
You can argue to the jury, look, the statute says habitual. You're the judge of what habitual is. And surely habitual means a whole career of crime. Enough criminal activity to show that you're a habitual lawbreaker rather than these two or three previous crimes. Under C, that's a perfectly permissible argument, isn't it?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And with respect to the two toothbrushing... In this instance, with the predicate felonies, it's just established by the statute that two predicate felonies...
So all your argument really comes down to is that there was no reason for the lawyer to anticipate C.
That's correct, Your Honor.
From the blue.
I would agree with that. If the court has no further questions, I believe that the district court correctly denied habeas relief.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mark.
Thank you.
Mr. Pope, how much time does he have? Maybe you could answer this question. Now, so did your argument come down to that his appellate lawyer, should have anticipated C and made the argument? Is that what you're...
I don't think his lawyer even had to anticipate C. I think the law was clear at the time, and you'll see in the Duff case and the merge...
C didn't change the law, is that what you're saying?
C declared it more definitively than it had been in the past. I think
when had it been declared in the past?
On page 19 of my opening brief. In Mers versus State in 1986, this is prior to his direct appeal, the court held that in habitual offender cases, Indiana juries have the authority to, quote, determine the ultimate issue of fact, whether based on the three felonies, defendant's sentencing should be that of an habitual offender. There's also a concurring opinion in 1987.
Well, wait a second. Are they talking about the facts or the law?
I believe if you look at that case, they're talking about the law, Your Honor. And I think Duff, which I believe cites Mers, confirms that. And Duff says that the jury has the unquestioned right.
What do you do about the fact that C itself says explicitly? explicitly that it is departing from the prior established law in Indiana, and in particular departing from Clark from 1990 and departing from Duff?
I believe you know, those cases were, you know, I think it was departing in other ways than we have here, and as the court recognized in Merz and Duff. I think what that decision did was merely clarify a question that was a little bit nebulous, but nevertheless an issue that counsel should have raised, and an issue that trial counsel recognized and the trial judge recognized.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. And you were representing him at the request of the court, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts. Next case for argument.